the show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Yeah, here we go. Time for more of the Bucket Strategy Investing program. We're going to get things rolling with yet another hour of the best in money information. I'm Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum back with me once again from Lucia Capital Group. As always, a lot of stuff to cover this hour, but phone calls are coming up first. Some folks have been hanging on and we're going to get to them right away. You are required to join them to take part in the program. Your chance to call in is right now. I believe we have a line, maybe two open right now. Try it. You got a money question, a strategy question, we're here to answer it for you. Here's what you do. You go to your phone, you give us a call, 877-PLANNER, 877-752-6637. You can also send us your email questions, your comments, whatever. Head on over to wealthed.com, click on the Find Your Answer link, fill in the blanks. We will get it right here in the studio and answer those questions. In fact, had a couple of really good corporation questions from last hour that we're going to answer this hour on the emails. Wealth education, that's what we try to provide here, and much of what you see and hear on the show can be found at wealthed.com. You can also contact the Brain Trust off the air. Their phone number, 800-644-1150. You can give them a call. You meet with a Brain Trust advisor. You go over your individual situation and get your buckets strategy going. You call Professor Plum or any of the advisors there at Lucia Capital Group. Their off-air number, again, 800-644-1150. Our number, on the air, important number, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. We got a couple of calls standing by. We're going to get first to Thomas in Atlanta, Georgia. Thomas, thanks for hanging on. How can we help you today? I think. Do we have Thomas? Oh, there we go. Yeah, Thomas, I'm sorry we missed you. Go right ahead.
Okay, the question is, I'm on disability retirement, and when I first started working for the company, it was taking out pensions, and they took it out a while, but now I get the letters from Social Security say I don't have enough points in, you know, to get receive Social Security.
So So you're on disability, not Social Security disability right now.
Yes, disability pension.
Okay, and
that's Social Security.
When you were working for the company, you were or were you not paying into Social Security?
I paid into Social Security about a year or maybe more, you know, then they changed over to the pension plan.
Okay, and then how long did you work after that?
Okay, I worked up until I worked for about 28 years.
Okay, so the disability happened long after you stopped paying into Social Security.
Yes.
Unfortunately, you only have a year or so in the Social Security system. That's only 4 credits or so.
Right.
You need 40 credits to get a retirement benefit. The disability
right.
happened long after you stopped paying into Social Security. So you're not eligible for any Social Security disability, and you don't have enough credits for Social Security retirement either. So this pension is the pension that you're going to be getting for the rest of your life.
Right.
But there won't be anything from Social Security coming. Now, are you married?
Yeah, I understand, yeah.
You're married?
Yes, sir.
How much is your pension right now?
A month or what?
Yeah, per month.
About 3,700. About 3,700.
Okay, you're not going to get any Social Security from your own work because you didn't pay into it long enough, nor from your spouse's work because of the government pension offset. So this pension is the income you're going to have. You're not going to get anything from Social Security.
Okay, then. The question was, since I can't get in a job with Social Security taken out, so I'm just lost that year out, 2 years I worked with Social Security.
Right, but Social Security has basically two benefits that you'd be concerned about. Well, three we'll talk about. Disability. Social Security disability, you have to work enough to be able to get a benefit, and you have to work close enough to the disability to be able to do it. You were 28 years of working after you stopped paying into Social Security. So that means that you're not currently insured for a disability benefit. You're not eligible for a disability benefit. Like if I quit working for whatever reason at 40 and then got disabled at 55, even though I paid into Social Security, I'm not going to get a disability benefit because I'm not protecting an income from Social Security. So you're not eligible for a disability benefit. Now, to get a retirement benefit, you need 40 credits, basically 10 years worth of work in the Social Security Administration. You don't have that. Now, you are married, so you would potentially be eligible for a spousal retirement benefit, but you have a pension from work not covered by Social Security, so you're going to be subject to something known as the government pension offset. And with a pension of $3,700, that's going to wipe out any Social Security benefit that you would ever be eligible for from your spouse.
Okay.
So you're not going, unfortunately, I don't have better news for you. You're not going to get Social Security.
Okay. I just wanted to know, I was just wondering.
Yes.
Well, what would happen? Yeah,
unfortunately, you're in a situation where you have a nice pension, but you're not going to get Social Security.
Yeah. But hey, you got the pension at least, Thomas.
Thankfully.
So that's something.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, then. That's all I need to know.
All right.
Okay.
Thomas, thank you for the call.
Oh, I appreciate you.
All right. Take care. Take care of yourself. Yeah. And you could look at this a couple of different ways if you want.
Hey, the pension's a savings grace. But that's also why he does not have the Social Security. He was paying into the pension, or they were paying into the pension system for him, and he earned that pension. And that pension, 37, is a lot better than any Social Security he would have ever gotten. That's higher than any Social Security benefit right now.
Than any benefit for anybody who worked well against the wage base, I mean, right up to the wage base.
At this point, even if you maxed out the wage base for the best 35 years you could have, and you waited until 70,
now
$3,700 a month is more than your Social Security.
So he spent almost 30 years working outside of the Social Security system,
yes.
Paying
and,
you know,
and earning his
and
pension.
Earning this pension, as he's been doing. He had worked for, I forget how long it was.
A year or two.
Just a couple of years in the Social Security.
Paying into Social Security.
Right. Now, if it's the windfall elimination that takes away.
Well, no, he's not eligible for his own. He doesn't have 40 credits.
Oh, that's right.
To get your own retirement benefit, you have to have 40 credits.
Right. So that wouldn't work for him.
So he's not eligible for retirement.
The government pension offset is the one that.
That's affecting the benefit that he could otherwise be eligible for from his spouse's work record.
Right.
Whether it's a spousal retirement benefit or a widower's benefit. Now, if his spouse is a very high wage earner and has a very, very, very high Social Security benefit and waits until 70 to take her benefit, there is a chance, very small chance, that he might get a widow's benefit for a couple $100 at some point in the future. But it's unlikely.
It's unlikely because?
Well, her benefit would have to exceed two-thirds of his pension. Two-thirds of his pension is roughly $2,500 a month.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good size Social Security benefit. Not that it can't happen. There are Social Security benefits in excess of $2,500, especially if somebody waits until age 70 to start it. But it's going to take a pretty good benefit to get there. That means somebody had to work at a fairly high rate for at least 35 years to get that size of a benefit. The government pension offset reduces any spousal or widow's benefit that I would otherwise be entitled to by an amount equal to two-thirds of my pension. Dollar for dollar reduction equal to two-thirds of my pension. His pension was $3,700 a month. So what's that? $2,433 a month, or $2,466 a month of any other Social Security that he's going to get, dollar is going to be wiped out dollar for dollar.
Yeah,
the spousal benefit's definitely not that high.
So unless a widow's benefit is larger than
$2,500, it's not going to get it.
But it could happen.
Now, disability is a strange one. You don't need 40 credits to get a disability benefit, but you do have to have been working in a time frame close enough to the disability to claim that you were trying to protect that income that you were getting or potentially working into the Social Security. So once you've been out of the Social Security workforce for at least 5 years, even if you have 40 credits, you're not going to get a disability benefit.
You mean you're not going to be able to start a disability benefit?
Right. Now, you can't apply for one. So if I, like I was mentioning, if I retire at 45, or if I leave employment where I'm paying into Social Security at 45, and then at 53, 54, 55, I become disabled. Well, I'm obviously too young for a retirement benefit from Social Security. I may have my 40 credits in, and when I get to retirement, I may be able to get a retirement benefit, but I do not have enough credits in a time proximity close enough to the beginning date of my disability to be eligible for a disability benefit. I have to have at least half the credits in the last 10 years that were earned to be able to be eligible for a disability benefit. Obviously, the number is a little bit smaller if I'm only 25 when I get disabled. But you can't leave work and then
get disabled, 10, 15 years
later and then say, well, I'm on a disability benefit.
I want to clear this up only because people sometimes listen or watch. They're not listening, you know, fully attentively. When you say that, I mean, if you're receiving a benefit, you get disabled, and right away you go on Social Security disability. They're not going to take that away from you after 5 years.
And if I get disabled 4 years after I retire, I win the lottery and I retire at 45, and then at 49, I get disabled because I'm out, parasailing or hang gliding or something. I have a little accident. I get disabled. I'm within the time frame that I can, even though I haven't worked for 4 years and I have no intention of going back to work, I won the lottery. I can get a Social Security disability benefit because I'm within the time frame.
So obviously there's no income. I mean, there's no
I'm not protecting my income.
Right, yeah.
Oh, there's no net worth requirements, high or low.
No, there aren't. I had that
question once too. Social Security is not means tested.
No,
SSI is means tested.
That's right. And that's the
supplemental social insurance.
Supplemental social insurance, which, yeah.
Different than Social Security disability.
Exactly. SSDI, SSI. Okay. 877-PLANNER, our number, PLANNER. Slava, give us a call back. I know you had a question on a deed of trust. We'll try to get to that. And anything else, some emails to get to as well. A lot of things to talk about, not a ton of time. So call 877-PLANNER. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. It is Bucket Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, taking your calls till the top of the hour. Got a little bit of room, but not much on the phones. 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. We'll get some of these emails, too, at wealthed.com. Wealthed.com and find your answer link. Let's get back to the phone lines, though. I understand we have Slava back with us. Good. In Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Slava. How can we help you today?
Yes. My question is, approximately 15 years ago, my husband died, and I take my daughter for the deed for my property. And now we decided we have to transfer this for trust. And I really don't know what is better, is the revocable living trust or irrevocable living trust.
Well, so the question is, do you want to put it into an irrevocable trust or a revocable trust, a living trust? The reason for putting it into the trust is what? Do you want it out of your name and out of your life? And you want it away from you, or what is the purpose?
No, I want to be still. I still my wife. That's my property, and she be like beneficiary. After I die, she be automatically be owner.
Okay, well, you can do it through either type of trust, but the difference is, who's the beneficial owner? A living trust is a lot easier to deal with. You are basically the owner of the asset. It's held in the living trust. Living trusts are primarily for probate estate planning purposes so that it will pass very easily, hopefully a lot easier than through probate, to your daughter or your heirs in the event you pass away. It is a holding account, a holding asset, so that it doesn't go through probate. An irrevocable trust is a completely separate issue. You are no longer the beneficial owner of it. You may be allowed to live there, but the trust is in control and it has to file its own tax returns and everything. If all you're doing is trying to make sure that the beneficiaries receive it in a more efficient manner, taking it away from the courts and away from probate when you die, the living trust is a better deal. If you're trying to protect yourself from liabilities and some other things, and you're doing some very high-end planning, then an irrevocable trust may or may not deal with it. If there are times where we've seen what they call personal residence trusts, where the value of the house is very large, and we want to try to reduce the value of the house for estate tax purposes. We're over the $5,450,000 limit, and we want to be able to somehow pass the house to our kids, but if we do so when we die, they're going to have to pay a big estate tax. We can do some of these personal residence trusts to reduce the value by making a future gift. It's kind of crazy. That's where irrevocable trusts can come in play. But for what it sounds like you want to do, which is just be able to pass it to the beneficiary more efficiently, a living trust will be where you're looking at.
That's supposed to be altogether a revocable living trust or only living trust?
It's a revocable
living trust.
Meaning I can change it. I can revoke the trust. I can change it. It's a revocable living trust. It is not an irrevocable. Irrevocable means I can't change it.
Like I give him for her, I'm nothing. Zero.
I from what I understand you're trying to do, I would do an irrevocable living trust.
Okay. Okay, okay. Thank you. I understand now. Perfect.
Okay, all right. Slava, thank you for the call. Yeah, there's a big difference between the two.
Right, and one of them is a living trust is primarily an estate planning tool to avoid probate. Most people are going to be subject to some probate. You don't have to be a millionaire to have to worry about probate. So living trusts are significantly more common than irrevocable trusts. Irrevocable trusts are dealt with to move money outside of our estate, to take something that we own today that would be included in our estate and move it outside of our estate for estate tax purposes. We see this a lot with life insurance, where if it's in my estate, it may be taxed fairly heavily, but I want it to be used to pay for the estate taxes, so I move it out of my estate so that it's not part of the estate itself. We see it used for a liability planning purpose, where if I don't own it and somebody were to sue me, they can't take it from me because I don't own it. The trust owns it. I have a beneficial interest, but I'm not the trustee. I'm not in control. I may be allowed to use the asset at the trustee's, not my, discretion. So there's some liability issues with irrevocable trusts, but there's also some tax issues with irrevocable trusts.
Irrevocable
trust. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I just want to
make
sure,
because catching me.
There's a distinction between the two.
Yeah, one is a separate, completely separate tax entity. It has separate ownership. It has separate everything. The other one, the living trust, the revocable, changeable,
or
living,
revocable
living trust.
We'll change. We'll
put the emphasis. That. I still technically own it. I control it. It's mine. For all intents and purposes, it is not going to protect me from any liabilities. It is purely to avoid probate when I pass. So you'll see them done at different times for different reasons. An irrevocable, non-changeable, separate entity, that's a whole different game. And unfortunately, we see a lot of people that are being told a living trust, which is a revocable trust, I can change it, protects you for liabilities. No, it doesn't. If somebody sues you, the living trust is invisible to that. And I've heard it said that the living trust helps you with your taxes. Nope. A living trust is invisible for income taxes. Doesn't have anything to do with it. A irrevocable trust is a different tax entity. An irrevocable trust has tax issues, benefits or pros or cons, depending upon how you want to look at it. But as far as a living revocable trust is, it's invisible for liabilities. Doesn't do anything. It's invisible for taxes. Doesn't do anything. It's an estate planning tool.
Yeah, mainly to avoid probate.
To avoid probate. Yeah. Now, it does allow it also has control. It allows for control. So if I'm alive and I, for whatever reason, I don't want to or I can't handle my own financial affairs, there's a succession of who's going to manage the assets on my behalf while I'm alive. That can be very nice for people in older ages or if an unfortunate accident happens. And then after I pass away, it can provide continuation of management without going through probate for heirs that I may or may not trust so much. So there's a lot going on.
Which again makes it part of an estate planning tool. If you put stuff in an irrevocable trust, meaning you can't change it. I mean, that is what it says. You cannot change it. So that actually is completely out of your estate now.
It is not part of my estate. It is a gift. Whatever I give
the
over
trust
there,
owns it.
It's
now.
A gift. So if I, give it $1 million piece of property, that's a gift from my estate. So that would be potentially part of that gift tax area
exclusion,
that we talked about the other day. And so it reduces what I can give at my death. And so it is a gift. But that's also where we're trying to potentially at times reduce the value of the gift if I'm giving a minority interest in something there's all kinds of techniques and trades.
Right.
We used to do this a lot back when the estate tax limit was $600,000. Mm-hmm. Now with the estate tax limits at $5,450,000 and having the portability to stack a spouse's unused credit on top of a surviving spouse's credit and get potentially $11 million worth of exemption from estate taxes, we just don't see these techniques being used all that often.
No, and I suppose that's probably a good thing because...
It depends on if you're a lawyer that specializes in it or not.
Most people are not. Most people are not, and they just want to make sure that they have... Well, the good example of that is one that you mentioned with life insurance.
Yes.
You want to get it out of your estate. Maybe you have a $2, $3 million life insurance policy.
Or more.
And you've got a $3 million estate.
You're single.
And
that life insurance is going to put you over the limit, have to pay some taxes.
Exactly, which normally you wouldn't have to do on life insurance, but there you go.
Not income taxes.
No. estate taxes. All right, 877-PLANNER, our number, PLANNER. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, more of your phone calls and emails coming up. Call now. We're coming right back. Bucket Strategy Investing, Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. We're answering your money questions. 877-PLANNER, PLANNER. We're here every day at this time. We're here till the top of the hour. So if you have a money question, you need it answered before said top of hour, you call right now, 877-752-6637. Emails, yes. Get to those in just a second. That's at wealthed.com, our website, wealthed.com. Click on the Find Your Answer link. And speaking of wealthed.com, that's where you can go to sign up for one of the many workshops that are happening across the country with the Brain Trust over the next couple of weeks, months, whatever it happens to be. Now, if you're listening or watching us, there's a pretty good chance that we're going to be in a city or town or at least a zip code near you. So what you should do is go over to wealthed.com, and look at the schedule. I think there's still several cities left before we get to the end of the spring series. So the best thing to do, as I said, you go over to wealthed.com, meet the Brain Trust, Professor Plum, Terry Keyes, and the local advisors will be traveling around talking to you about your money, talking to you about strategies. And one of the cool things about these workshops, Professor Plum, is that you get to find out what's on people's minds, you know, in different sections of the country.
And different sections have different considerations.
They really do. I mean, you know, some have more Social Security concerns.
Some are all annuities.
Some are all annuities. I know in the Phoenix area, we get a lot of those in the Phoenix area.
Different areas have a lot of real estate questions. Depending on where we are, we used to get a lot of real estate questions in Nevada and Phoenix, but in Arizona, but then it died down for a little bit. Different kinds of questions, I guess, we got after that.
I remember Las Vegas was big for many years on real estate, and then all of a sudden, of course, you know.
It wasn't. And then going back even further than that, back in the heyday of the dot-coms, the Bay Area was ridiculous with real estate questions.
Oh, sure, yeah. So anyway, but what this does, it gives us an opportunity to find out what's on your mind and, by the way, answer the questions that are important to you. So you bring your money questions. They're all free. You go to wealthed.com to sign up. Once again, check out where the Brain Trust is going to be. Our phone lines are open, 877-PLANNER, PLANNER, 877-752-6637. Now, in a previous hour, we were talking about incorporating, Professor Plum, and some of the benefits of setting up a corporation. And we had an email last hour from Vincent, and I wanted to get to it here because it's timely and it was a good question. He says, Vincent in Alexandria, Virginia, I had a question regarding your excellent discussion of setting up a corporation. Well, thank you. If I have a sole proprietorship and am considering setting up a corporation, is there a certain amount of business income I should realize before setting up a corporation makes sense? In other words, does income enter into the decision?
Well, income is one of the deciding factors, but it's not the only one. The other one, as I mentioned, is liability. Do you face liability? Either through employees or the product or the service that you're providing or the what you're selling or what you're doing. If there is a liability, if I had employees, I'm incorporating or doing an LLC regardless of my income level, even if I'm showing negative numbers on my actual income every
year. If you have employees.
If I have employees, because I want to shelter my personal life from their, in many cases, not even their intentional screw up, but sometimes people do some very crazy things and I want to shelter myself. Or if I have partners in the business, I want to have an entity around me, not just a straight partnership, to protect myself from the liability of these other individuals. Now, on the income side, if I'm a consultant, I don't have any assets, I'm just me, I do all the work, I'm the one, everything is me, then I'm really not protecting myself from liability in any way, because no matter what happens, they can trace it back to me, and anything that's going to get sued, they're going to sue me personally and the business if I have a business. So from a liability standpoint, if it's just me, that's not going to help so much. So now I am looking for an income level. Where does it make sense? And it depends on the state that you live in to some degrees, because a state like California charges you $800 a year just to have the liability, either a limited liability company or a corporation. So there are certain thresholds, different accounting, more things that you really want to have a little bit of income. Now, the higher the income, the more likely you're going to do it. Especially the higher the income that I can separate between the two different classes of income, employee income and employer income, profit. So the more I can separate those two issues, the better I can deal with on some other areas. Now, if I have a day job where I'm making good money, I may be making at or above the wage base, and then I have a side job where I turned a hobby into a side business that's actually making some money, that dictates whether I'm going to do an LLC or an S-Corp. Where normally with a business, I'm going to go towards an S-Corp. Where it's that situation, I'm going to go to an LLC because I've already satisfied the wage base through my day job. And I can, if I end up incorporating this side business, I end up paying a little bit more in FICA taxes than I would otherwise pay. So you really have to look at what's going on, where the income's coming from, where in the whole area, not just the one job, but everything, to determine whether or not it makes sense to incorporate. But so, then if there's a liability issue, I don't care what the income level is, I'm going to do it just for the liability side.
All right, so the first thing you're going to look at is liability.
Yep.
Second thing you're going to look at, if there really isn't much a chance of liability.
Protection.
Yeah, then you're going to say income becomes more important the more you make.
Is there enough tax savings, enough other things involved to make it worthwhile?
Yeah, I mean, if you're only pulling in, you know, a couple of grand a year.
Yeah, if I'm pulling 5, 8, 10 grand a year, I'm not going to incorporate just to save taxes because there's just not enough there to make it worthwhile. You got to pay for the incorporation. You got to pay for an extra tax return and some other things. On the other side, if I have employees, and even if I'm only making, you know, I basically let the employees run it, let somebody else run it, and I just take the profits because that's the way I am. I don't actually set, but I'm only making a couple $1,000 a year. I'm still going to incorporate or do an LLC just to protect myself from the business.
Sure, yeah.
So income is one source. Liability is another source of decision making to determine whether you want to or do not want to create some kind of an entity. I don't want to say incorporate because you may only be using an LLC. And using an LLC is actually not incorporating. An LLC is a limited liability company.
And it is transparent for tax purposes.
Totally transparent for tax purposes.
Whereas
if I'm a single member LLC.
Yes. Now, a corporation obviously is not.
Corporation is an actual corporation.
Yes, yes. And it requires its own tax return too, by the way. Now, when we since he brought it up, corporations, we've heard, although for whatever reason not as much lately,
incorporating in Nevada?
The old Nevada corporation. And if you go way back, it used to be Delaware corporations, which
well,
I know
still
are
Delaware
still there.
Delaware is still there.
And that's less of a problem. I mean, there are reasons to do that. Where we really got into some hot water with, not we, where people get into hot water is the whole idea of incorporating in Nevada
to
and
save,
trying to avoid state income taxes.
Right. And for somebody who lives in Nevada and incorporates in Nevada, they're going to avoid Nevada state income taxes. But that has nothing to do with the incorporation because Nevada doesn't charge an income tax. But if you live in California, Arizona, one of the neighboring states, or any of the
anywhere.
States.
You could live in
and
Florida.
And you incorporate in Nevada, but you live in California. You work in California. You just have all the receipts and everything sent through a P.O. box in Nevada and then resent to you the profits in California. That doesn't get away from California income tax. You're a resident of California, they're going to tax you. The work was performed in California, they're going to tax you. And I mean, even athletes who don't live in California, people that you know have jobs where they live in other states, but they come to California to work for a little bit. An athlete, a baseball player, a football player, where they play in multiple different states. They've got to fill out tax returns for all these different states. And California, if somebody that lives in Florida, and comes to California, plays 8 or 10 times a year in California, they have to prorate their income for the amount of money they made in California and pay California taxes on it.
Well, they got to do it for wherever they play.
Wherever.
Oregon, New York, Massachusetts.
Right.
Which is, now, you have a lot of these athletes who live in states like Texas or Florida where there isn't a state income tax.
So they don't have to pay taxes in their home state.
Which half their games oftentimes are played there.
Hopefully. But they do have to pay taxes on the other states if that state has an income tax. So just incorporating in Nevada does not save you income taxes unless you do the work and live in Nevada.
Now, why is it that these were so long touted as being a way to save state income taxes? You have a P.O. box you set up somewhere in Nevada. That is your home address. And, I mean, people couldn't have gotten away with it if they ever got audited. Certainly, the IRS is one of the first things they're going to catch.
Well, the IRS isn't going to catch it. The franchise tax.
You're right. I'm sorry, because it's a state
income
tax.
And I remember years ago we had a representative from the California Franchise Tax Board, the collection agency for California, on the air with us, and they said, oh, we don't mind them incorporating in Nevada. We're going to find them, and by the time we find them, not only do they owe all the back taxes, but they're going to owe interest and penalties, and we're going to get more money from them that way. So it's okay, because we'll catch them in 4 or 5 years. And it was like, wow, that's,
Yeah, but the problem was
were they being touted that way? Because we wanted to hear it. We want to find a way to avoid taxes. And it sounds really reasonable. Hey, if I'm incorporated in a different state and all the money flows through a different state, then why wouldn't it be? Well, because it's not. It doesn't, because it all comes back to me here in the state where I'm being taxed. We do a lot of things, and a lot of marketing is geared towards getting you to believe something that you want to hear. You want to hear that you can have market-like returns with no risk. You want to hear that you can avoid income taxes by doing something very simple, by filling out some forms. We want to hear that there's no risk and there's great returns. Just because we want to hear it doesn't make it so.
No, it doesn't. You find out sometimes too late, and you wind up owing back state taxes and penalties, as Professor said, interest and all that. So just be careful. Anytime you hear one of these things being touted as the best thing in the world, this is going to solve all your problems, you know what you should do? Doubt it. Or if you think you shouldn't doubt it, you give us a call and we'll tell you one way or the other. 877-PLANNER. More emails coming up. We got some trivia just ahead, etc., etc. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum from Lucia Capital Group, stand by to take your calls on Bucket Strategy Investing. Bucket Strategy Investing. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. All right, so some trivia for today before we, we'll try to get to Dick's email if we can in Honolulu. I said it was kind of long. We're going to see if we can get to it here shortly. A couple of lines open, though, 877-752-6637. So the trivia for today comes to us from, we mentioned the IRS, they got their hands all over this one. This from Internal Revenue Service. The top 1% of U.S. taxpayers received 19% of all adjusted gross income nationwide in tax year 2013, down from just shy of 22% of AGI in tax year 2012.
I wonder why it was down. That's interesting.
In 2013. Now, 2013, you would think the top 1%
had a higher income. That was a very good year in the stock market.
It was a really good year in the stock market.
Which would have created a lot of adjusted gross income, assuming they sold something.
Well, now, unless they were just living off of... Well,
they had to sell it to get the...
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why that is. They didn't tell us why or when.
Well, both of them are, you know, right around that 20% mark, you know, a little bit over, a little bit under. So the top 1% of the
tax returns. And this isn't just a poll. This is the actual returns that we're talking about.
And so this is the adjusted gross income, which is the total income after a couple of deductions, but not the major deductions.
Right, exactly. So, Well, there you go.
And to be in that top 1%, your adjusted gross income needed to be a little bit over $380,000 a year. So that's what it takes. It's about the same this year. Or 15. About 380 a year, 390 to get into that top 1%.
Tell you what, somebody put me in that tax bracket, and I'll tell you how much my AGI is. I'll add to that stat. All right, I will happily do so. All right, 877-PLANNER. Let's see if we can now hear an email from Dick in Honolulu. Now, Dick asked some questions here, but his first question, Professor Plum, may preclude us answering the others. Let's find out. He says, you have a great show and I learn a lot from you guys. Thank you, Dick. I have a Social Security question. Background, I'm 62 and a half. My full retirement age is about $2,600 monthly. My wife is 60 and her age 66 benefit is to be is much less than mine, less than half. My son is 31, disabled since birth. He collects SSI and is not employed. I trust he is considered a disabled adult child and eligible for benefits when I start collecting Social Security.
Yes.
Okay, now, good. The goal. I would like to start collecting child in care benefits for my wife as soon as possible, but I intend to keep working until I'm 66 and make more than Social Security would allow for me to retain benefits.
Okay, so he's making obviously more than $16,000 a year. So that would he would fail the retirement earnings test.
Yes, until such time as he turns 66.
Until he gets the full retirement age.
Uh-huh. Questions. Can I apply for Social Security now, but not collect benefits or alternatively return the money each year and still have my wife collect child and care benefits? If so, would those child and care benefits be at one half my benefit at age 66, even if I apply at age 62? Okay, well.
Well, if you apply now, they will take the money back. You're not going to have a choice. As soon as they match up the tax return, they're going to say, he's working, he's receiving benefits, he's under full retirement age, he wasn't eligible for a benefit. So you're going to have to pay the money back. But also, anybody else who received a benefit from your work record will also have to pay the money back. Your wife won't get a free ride on this. Your child won't get a free ride on this. If you're aced out of the benefit, everybody's aced out of the benefit because of the retirement earnings test. Everybody's aced out of it that's collecting on your work record. Now, if for some reason you did retire and you weren't working and your wife was eligible for a child and care benefit, then her benefit is based on 50% of your full retirement age benefit. The dependent adult child and the child and care benefit for the spouse caring for is based on the full retirement benefit, and it's 50%, subject to a family maximum. So if you were to retire, the second answer is yes, 50%. But she's not eligible for it unless you're receiving your benefit. And you're not going to be receiving your benefit because you're not eligible for it because of the retirement earnings test.
Yeah, now, as you said, if he stopped working, then that might be a different story. Now, he says, if that is not possible, is there another strategy I can use to commence child and care benefits starting right now?
The only strategy is quit work.
The work is what's holding it up here.
Work's the issue. You're 62 and a half. You're technically eligible by age for a retirement benefit, but you're not eligible because you're working. So what's holding you back is you're working. So the only way to get the benefits you're looking for is to quit working.
Well, because the only way to get these benefits, for your family to get these benefits, is for you to get your own benefits. You have to be receiving
right.
the benefit. In order for you to receive the benefit, you need to be, you need to not be working because you're not age 66.
And because you're only 62 and a half and won't be able to voluntarily suspend it by April of this year, the rules will never change on that. You'll always have to be receiving your benefit for these other individuals to be receiving a benefit.
Now, he's asking some other questions. Does my son need to collect these benefits to allow my wife to collect child and care benefits, or are they independent?
Well, they're not independent. Your wife cannot collect a child and care benefit unless there's a child in care receiving a benefit. And so if he's not getting a benefit, your wife's not getting a benefit. If you're not getting a benefit, neither one of them are getting a benefit.
Okay, so, and he says complicated stuff. I'll just ask his other question. Since my salary would preclude retaining Social Security benefits prior to age 66, what is the process to apply for Social Security at age 62? Well, there really isn't.
There isn't one.
There isn't one, yeah.
The process to apply is the same process as everything, but they're just going to take it away from you. So, and there's no, what's the process? There really isn't one for this because you're not eligible.
Yeah, so there's no penalty for doing A since you can't do it. That's what he's asking. Overall, my strategy would be to have my wife collect her child and care benefits now. My son continue to receive SSI, and I would work till age 66 and fully retire. But again, he can't do that. So he just wanted to know, is that feasible or what's the alternative? And he says, mahalo, which we say back to.
Thank you,
to.
But yes. Unfortunately, there's the only alternative is to quit working right now.
Yeah.
Now, once you get to 66, you'll be able to do it. Of course, you'll have to start receiving your benefit. You won't be able to file and suspend it because you're not old enough for that option anymore. To be able to have the file and suspend option so that somebody else can receive a benefit from your work record, you would have to do that before the end of April of this year. And you won't be old enough to do it before the end of April this year. That's one of the things they took away from us. So you're going to have to, at 66, if you want, and it probably does make sense, to start receiving that benefit at 66.
Okay, well, there you go. Dick, I know there's a lot of questions, and I know we couldn't answer them all, only because, not that we couldn't answer them all, but the answer was no because...
We didn't give him the answer he wanted.
Exactly, because the only way to do it. So I don't know if it's possible to maybe quit work, or maybe it isn't, but if you did, then some of this stuff could be possible. Okay, if you're on hold, hang on a second. We're going to get to everybody. Our phone number off the air. If you need to talk to Professor Plum or any of the Brain Trust advisors across the country at Lucia Capital Group, their phone number is as follows, 800-644-1150, 800-644-1150. For Professor Rick Plum, I am Johnny Dean. This is Bucket Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.